Welcome to How to Become a Leader in Africa, the podcast where we explore the fascinating logic behind leadership in African societies through conversations with Africans from all walks of life. I'm your host, Remy Adekoya. Let's dive into this week's discussion. Our guest today is Andrew Cayley, a former vice presidential candidate in Sierra Leone with a vast range of leadership experience in both the private and public sector. Mr. Cayley is currently the chairman of Sierra Leone's Electricity Distribution and Supply Authority, which is the main entity responsible for electricity supply in the country. He's also the managing director of SEMATS Group Limited, a major engineering company in Sierra Leone. And Mr. Cayley also has vast leadership experience in Sierra Leone's mining sector, which is particularly well known for its diamonds. We can safely say our guest today is a man of many hats. Mr. Cayley, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Remy. It's good to be here.
So, sir, you were the vice presidential candidate for the National Grand Coalition in Sierra Leone's 2018 presidential elections. Could you share with us perhaps some of your experiences on the campaign trail, what they taught you about the kind of leadership Sierra Leoneans are looking for, and what they taught you about the imaginations Sierra Leoneans have of what constitutes a good leader?
I was very pleased to be vice presidential candidate in 2018 to Dr. Kande Yumkela. It was a new party. NGC was a new party that wanted to upend the dominance of the two parties that had been in Sierra Leone since independence, the Sierra Leone People's Party and the APC. So it was quite a venture we embarked upon, but I think it was good because we were supported a lot by disaffected intelligentsia, people in the diaspora, young people. We were very well received on our campaign travels. We went all over the country. We visited various parts. We held rallies. We went to see various people. We had dedicated teams all over the country, and we met people from all walks of life, including traditional leaders, youths, and various people. We appeared on the media. We went around with our volunteers. So it was quite good. To me, it was an object lesson in geography of this country. I went to parts of Sierra Leone that I knew I would never go to. And the campaign itself went quite well.
And what were some of the stories you can recall for us on the campaign trail? You know, what were some of the recurring questions people asked? What were the expectations they have of those who would want to lead their country?
I think we were very confident because people were very disappointed. The youths we met were looking for employment. They were looking for a better plan. The students we met were looking at solutions to educational system. The people we met in the hinterland were looking at improvements in their agriculture, improvements in their way of life, because everybody has now deserted them to come to the city. The traditional leaders we met were looking for changes to be made in our governance system. So everybody had something he was looking forward to. But basically, the economy was a paramount thing. People were, as you know, Sierra Leone is a relatively poor country. Mm-hmm. People were looking at the improvement of their lot. And they thought that maybe since they had problems with the traditional parties that had existed, they will have much more hope with a new party. So we are very, very confident. And the youths especially were very supportive. We thought we got a lot of people that had never been interested in politics, intelligentsia, Sierra Leoneans in the diaspora. So the euphoria was there, and we thought we had a lot of support. The elections proved otherwise.
Yes, because I think your party placed third, your ticket placed third. But before we get there to sort of the reasons potentially for that, what I found interesting, you talked about how your campaign was able to reach a lot of disaffected members of the electorate. You mentioned the intelligentsia, people who were not previously interested in politics or perhaps didn't think there was any party out there that could represent their interests. And this is a story which I think repeats itself in many African societies today, that level of disaffection with politics. What do you think it was that your party did that enabled you resonate with those members of the electorate? What was the gap you filled?
Well, the gap we filled, I think the traditional parties were very regional. You've had a situation in Sierra Leone where the SLPP had always got most of its votes in the southeast, the APC in the northwest. So the country was a little bit divided along those lines. The younger people that are coming up, we thought were quite different. They wanted a unified Sierra Leone. We also thought that the parties that had existed had not sorted out basic problems of high unemployment rates for our youths, problems with agricultural production, problems with the lifestyle of people. They had not made a dent, much of a dent in the poverty situation, and also in terms of provision of basic infrastructure services, electricity, water. So we thought we had a good campaign message. We wrote a good manifesto. We had good slogans. We went around. And it resonated with a lot of the young people, especially, and the intelligentsia. However, as I did mention, there were other factors that would later militate against us.
So could you share with us some of those other factors? Because this, your ticket sounds like a classic change ticket. So then what was it that ultimately prevented that change in your view?
It's a classic change. Incidentally, just for disclosure, I was also an aspirant for the SLPP flag bearer position in the previous election. Okay. There are 19 of us, and I came third. But something happened, and we got disaffected and moved out of a traditional party into a new party. Part of the problem about a new party having traction, a big part of it is money. New party, you don't have access to resources. The government in power has got a lot of access to resources, sometimes using state resources. Mm-hmm. Even the main opposition has got some people that were in governance before that could be supported. They were supported by their members and business houses. So finance was one big thing. The other big thing was the division in the country along tribal and regional lines. Okay. In the long run, even those that wanted change would sit down and think about it, and they wanted patronage. They would say, oh, if a party comes that is a Southeastern party and we have patronage, there is much more hope than these going to these new people. So there was always that doubt, that lingering doubt as to whether a new party will come and make a difference. And that affected us a lot. And thirdly, even in terms of the way the elections were run, you're supposed to have your agents and the electoral commission. We sort of thought that a lot of the laws that they made, a lot of the regulations that they made, militated against us. And in the long run, even some of the traditional rulers had to toe the line a little bit and not venture into new things. So there were a lot of things going for keeping the status quo. Mm-hmm. And people will tell you in the long run, yes, we want to vote for you, but I was born into SLPP. I was born into APC. My parents were this and that. I stand more of a chance being under that umbrella. So I think people need more education. Yes, there were people who changed. There were people who bought our message. And those bold people, they're still there, and they want change within the country. But in the long run, tradition trumps any venture into new forays.
Wow, that's very interesting. So if we talk now about those two major parties, which you say people said either, you know, I was born into SLPP, I was born into APC. What is their support based on? Is it based more on patronage that basically speaking, they take care, quote unquote, of their voters financially? Or is it based on identity, ethno-regional identity? Sort of where do they draw, what's their support based on?
Well, funnily enough, I think what it's a little bit of all. The SLPP is traditionally a Southeastern party, even though some of its founders came from the North. The APC was rebelled against them, and they are traditionally a northern party, and they are more inclined to have the masses with them. And both of them have different ideologies. In the past, SLPP was very conservative and traditional. APC was led more in the immediate post-colonial days to communist countries, to the Soviet bloc and communist countries. But later on, all of this changed, and it became more a regional party. Both of them became a regional party. And they provided, patronage is very important here, because when you're in government, you provide all the jobs, because the private sector is very small. You provide patronage, you provide development to various areas. You can decide to take development to your particular area. And funny enough, the leaders have always followed this. So you have the traditional people from those areas following them. The only person that broke the trend a little bit was President Tijan Kaba. He came in, and even though he was from the north, he had southern roots as well. And he was very, very national in character. And, you know, he ended the war. And after the war, when peace came, people were very supportive of his initiatives that brought about peace. So he had a very large majority of about 72% of the vote. So that is the only person that has bucked the trend. But otherwise, we came back to normal. And SFPP is a basic traditional Southeastern party. APC is a northern party. As to whether this will change, yes, it may change with more education. It may change with more private sector participation in the economy so that people don't have to depend on government largesse. But it suits the politicians fine to preach that message. And when you go into a traditional area and try to preach a different message, people will say, yes, we buy it, but let's wait a little bit. We still want our patronage.
Interesting. So what then would be the way out of this? Because these are stories I've, you know, heard in many African societies on this show and in other places, this sort of voter expectation of patronage. So if on the one hand, we say we want change, I think probably a significant number of voters would say they want change, they want, you know, better lives. But on the other hand, are also asking people running for office to provide them with cash or some other kind of patronage. You know, how do we get out of that? Because it seems like a vicious circle.
Yeah, but some things are changing. Take the issue of gender. It's changing a little bit because that is now legislated. With the gender acts and so on, you're supposed to have at least one-third representation in parliament and in councils. Yes. And it's changing things. There is a district called Kailaun where there is an NGO called Send Sierra Leone that has been educating voters and training women in leadership. And you have more women councillors in that district than men and in any other district in Sierra Leone. And the issue of education, if you campaign to the universities, the more educated people are, the more they are prone to change in those areas. So as education improves, things are bound to change. And with the more participation in terms of private sector participation in the economy and the NGOs coming in and civil society playing a part in educating people as to what their rights should be, certain things are changing a little bit, and we've had a few surprising results. It's not bucked the trend, but I think with more of that, with more of education, with more of empowerment, with more of motivating people, and with more of more people coming into the fore that they think they can respect, that empathize with their situation, that motivate them, I think the situation will change. But I don't think a third force would make a change overnight. I think a third force is a gradual process. You have to be ready to go through several cycles of elections to be able to make it. And that is the challenge that we are facing, we are faced with now.
Hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. If so, please remember to like, subscribe, and share. You can also follow me on Twitter at RemyAdekoya1. Let's get back to the podcast. Wow, that's interesting. And you had mentioned that you were in one of the major parties before. So as our podcast is focused on, you know, how to become a leader in Africa and essentially how people climb up the leadership ranks in their societies, what then does it take to climb up the leadership rank in one of those major political parties? what kinds of people tend to rise to the top there?
I think you will have to be connected to the party for a very long time. You have to be connected to the base. Because the very way that they vote at elections, they start from the base at the zonal level, to chiefdom level, to district level, to provincial level, to national level. And you have delegates at all of those levels. So if you don't start from the base and make sure that you support that base, and the way to do it is to try to be close to your own area. Like I was from the east, I was from Kailawan district. You try to get support from your area. You try to give them support once in a while in some of their development projects. You identify with them. You take part in the politics. You attend conventions and so on. Then you start talking to the rest of the people at the top, the women's wing, the men's, the secretary general, various elders in the party. Make yourself known and then preach your message. That is the way, when we stood at that time, there were 19 of us. I was a relatively new person in politics, but I still came third. But then it's a very deceptive process because people like money. And, I remember the particular case of a particular lady candidate who thought that she would win. And when the votes were counted, she only got one vote. That was her own vote. And then she turned around to a major supporter who was also a delegate and said, the guy told him, so, that one vote was mine. I dropped it for you. He said, you mean I didn't vote for myself? And you have such deceit in those kind of things. The way money plays a part, the way regionalism plays a part, the way ethnicity plays a part, all come in. But money is also important and your message is important. And association with the party for a very long time, going through the various ranks and talking to people and identifying with their aspirations, that does help.
That's really interesting what you say, and the example you give of that female candidate. These are the kinds of stories I've heard several times within Nigerian politics of people coming in, running in primaries, and they're promised a lot of things by the delegates. Of course, we'll support you. No problem. Don't worry. We'll be there for you on election day. And then when the actual, votes are counted at the primaries, they find themselves with almost nothing, even though sometimes they may have been attending their constituency for a year or so and, trying to win friends, let's call it, for the past year. And they've been promised all sorts of things. So that's very interesting. So then sort of digging further, you talked about how you have to start at the base if you want to rise up the ranks in one of those two major political parties. So what you seem to describe was relationship building. You said you have to have a good relationship with the delegates there, etc. So that relationship building, again, is it just financial? Is it more than that? Is it, attending the funerals of people, attending birthday parties, being there for them? What's the, we've talked about the financial element, of course, but as you mentioned, there are also people who come into politics sort of from the outside who even have a little bit of financial resources. I've known people like that in the Nigerian context. They come in, they have some financial resources, they spend some money, but at the end of the day, there's no result for it because somehow, when the votes are counted, the primary delegates don't back them. They back someone else. So is it just money here, or are there some other factors at play that you have to be really aware of?
No, it's not just money. As you say, it's identifying with them. Weddings and funerals and traditional occasions that they have, identifying with the aspirations, even with secret societies like the Bondo or Poro, the Bondo for women, Poro society for men. They initiating some young people, you support that venture. A lot of ventures that are traditional that you could support, identifying with the chiefs, the local young people in the area. There is what we call an attire base. They have where they drink their tea and get refreshments. They usually sit down there and pontificate about what kind of soil they want. You need to sit down with those kind of people, the downtrodden, the women, and just broaden your support base. If you do that, obviously it takes some time and energy and money to do that. But if you do that, you'll be at an advantage over somebody that just comes with money and wants to throw it around.
Wow, yeah, very interesting.
So money is important, but money is not the be-all and end-all of it all.
Very interesting. And so would you say there are certain kinds of character types or certain kinds of, you know, broadly speaking, of course, personality types that this kind of environment tends to favor more than others, whereby would you be able to look at someone who is, say, 25 now or 30 at the beginning of their political career, and would you be able to say, oh, yes, this person I think actually could go far in Sierra Leonean politics? Are there any kind of character traits like that you could point to?
Well, it depends upon what kind of position, but if you're going for elected positions...
Elected, yes.
I mean, you have a lot of positions that are appointed positions, but if you're going for elected positions, there are still a number of people who come in rather late, but they still put in the effort and they succeed. Perhaps those kind of people would need a bigger patronage, maybe supported by the head of state who would like that person to be a minister or whatever, or supported by the party officials in a particular area. So you do have that kind of patronage sometimes when you endear yourself. For example, the president is very powerful. There are members within the party that are powerful. So you could endear yourself and then take a shortcut, but you still have to do those kind of things. So I think if you're a young person and want to go into politics, it's not necessarily for those who are very serious-minded and want to write manifestos and write about what they want to do for the country. You've got to really go in and link up with people. That you have to be a people person. Otherwise, what you would do is just sit down and wait for an appointed position or wait for somebody that would extend his patronage to you and maybe just convince people to say, yeah, this is the person I support. I want you to continue supporting him.
Interesting. So you can either be a people person, build your own kind of base, your own level of popularity, and then perhaps the party bigwigs might notice you and say, oh, you know, this guy or this lady appears to be very popular with the people, so they may be worth backing. This is a horse worth backing. Or alternatively, if you endear yourself to one person, but a very powerful person within the party machinery, that person may then say, okay, yes, I'm going to support this candidate. And then things can fall into line based on that. That's very interesting. Yeah. And would you mind shedding just some more light, because you mentioned the role of secret societies in Sierra Leonean politics. Could you expand a bit more on what these societies do and sort of what bonds the people who are the members of this society together? Sort of what's that about?
Well, in the rural areas, you still have secret societies. They're powerful. You have Poro, Wunde. And they are both in the southeast and north of the country. Mm-hmm. These are societies that bond people together. I wouldn't explain too much about the machinations within there, mm-hmm. but you have to identify with what they do. You belong to a member of Poro and you sort of sign an oath of obedience to that society. And you identify with each other, you treat each other as comrades. So sometimes if you are not even a member of a secret society and you go to certain areas, it's very difficult to accept you. To the extent that some newbies that have gone into politics have actually gone in and joined those secret societies. Mm-hmm. Of course, you've got the Bondo for Women, that is really actually a traditional society that has this upside of things. Well, the FGM angle that puts some people off, but that is a subject of a very wide debate. But be that as it may, it's really identifying with the culture of people in those areas, and you have their own traditional societies that you need to join.
Very interesting. And in terms then, thinking about it from that human perspective of loyalty being something very important in order for any group to thrive, would you say those secret societies can sometimes be better at building loyalty amongst members to each other than perhaps some other more civic organizations like a political party, for instance? Do you think that is where part of their strength lies, in their ability to ensure the loyalty of their members to each other?
I don't know. I really believe that it's just a matter of saying, I identify with this secret society, so I'm one of you. But as to whether that plays a very large part, because you have several people that stand that are members of that secret society. So in the long run, something else is more important than just being a member of that secret society. But primarily, if you are not a member, then it puts you at a disadvantage.
I see it. I get that perfectly, the way you described it, sir. That wonderful, the way you described it. Thank you. That's very clear. Moving on. So reading about your announcement, when your candidacy was announced, I read an article in the Sierra Leonean Telegraph, which talked about how your grandfather had been a paramount chief. I understand your brother is also currently a paramount chief. And you've talked a little bit about traditional authority, especially in the rural parts of Sierra Leone. Does traditional authority still matter a lot to regular Sierra Leoneans? Is coming from that kind of lineage a significant advantage when running for political position?
Yeah, I think it is important. Take the case of the main people that are standing out. Even President Biya comes from a chieftaincy house.
The
His
current
father
president.
Was a paramount. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the current president.
Mm-hmm.
And even Dr. Kanu Yumkela, who was head of the NGC, of which I was vice presidential candidate, his father was a powerful paramount chief in the northern province.
Mm-hmm.
I come from the eastern province, and I come, as you mentioned, I come from a paramount chieftaincy house. My brother is currently the chief. What has happened is the chieftaincy is office is evolving now. You have a lot of educated people going to be chiefs. Like my brother used to run an engineering company in the US, and he came back to be a paramount chief. There are several people that have come from the diaspora because they want to claim their lineage to be paramount chiefs. And they're quite powerful in the traditional setting.
Mm-hmm.
However, as powerful as they are, their power will not be as much as it was before in the immediate post-colonial days, or maybe 10, 20 years ago, because a lot of the young people are now moving to larger towns. So you don't have, like they used to have chieftaincy farms. They used to have a lot of power over the economy of particular chiefdoms, with more civil society organizations coming in now and people knowing about their rights. This has got watered down a little bit, but the government still treats them with a lot of respect. Paramount chiefs are still represented in parliament. They have representatives of various districts in parliament. Paramount chiefs are members of the local governance council. They have some authority that they exercise in their areas. And the ones that come from mining areas are particularly well endowed because they get money from mining companies for surface rent and some other payments that are made to them. So they can be economically powerful as well. If you're a paramount chief, you come from a diamond mining area like Connor, you could be quite powerful. You don't only hold the traditional authority, you also have the resources. So you have that largesse to make use of. Well, having said that, their power is waned a little bit because of the, now you have decentralization with local councils in place. Also, central government has got a lot of power. They haven't really introduced very meaningful decentralization. And definitely, various governments almost demand covertly that you pay obeisance to them. So if you're a paramount chief, it's very difficult to come out openly against a sitting government.
Mm-hmm.
You may have your proclivities, but you'll keep it very close to your chest. And people will know that this is what you think about particular issues, but you dare not voice it out because they are under the thumb of whichever government is in power.
Yes.
So they tell you that we support any government in power. That's the best way to preserve their job.
Yeah.
But it's still a powerful institution.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're standing for elections, you really need to go to them. They will take you around because they are in charge of section chiefs, they're in charge of town chiefs. So those that command respect are respected in their chiefdoms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still a meaningful institution.
Very interesting, sir. And you said you used the keyword of, you said those that command respect. So aside being a titular traditional chief, do you still have to have one or two other attributes that will then lead to you commanding respect? or is it sort of instinctive on the behalf of the people now I'm talking about? And what is that authority really based on? Is it based on the idea that, okay, these are the people who are the custodians of my ethnic group's culture, and so I respect them based on that? Or what is the authority essentially derived from?
They have authority, some authority over land. For example, some land distribution, even though we have a Land Rights Act, a new customary Land Rights Act, they have some authority over land distribution.
Okay.
They have authority over leasing land to companies. Mm. That's why if you have a mining company in your chiefdom, you make a lot of money. Mm. They have authority over traditional disputes that take place in various areas. Mm. So when I say if you command respect, there are some that definitely are the subject to derision because they're not ruling properly, or they've done some unsavory act, or maybe they were not even in the line of a paramount chieftaincy lineage and they got elected because they were backed by the government. So some of those have got a lot of opposition from their subjects.
Okay.
And some paramount chiefs have been removed from office. Others are in office, but they're really not respected by their subjects.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to be respected and you're elected legitimately as a paramount chief, you come from a ruling house, and you rule justly, even in distribution of land, even in terms of how you adjudicate cases and issues like that, and you have some financial ledgers, you could be respected. And there are a lot of them that are respected.
Mm, interesting. And you spoke then about their role, especially you said the traditional rulers in the lands where there are diamonds have access to financial resources because those diamonds are in the areas where they are traditional rulers. What do you think, generally speaking, of the role the presence of diamonds have played in Sierra Leonean politics? And of course, we know about, you know, the civil war and the conflicts that happened before. But today, what role do you think diamonds play? I mean, you know, there's this whole theory about a resource curse, which some have talked about in the context of African nations, and not only African nations, saying, you know, those African nations in particular where there are resources like diamonds or gold, we tend to see conflict around there, and that it's brought more bad than good. What's your take on all this, on what, how that affects the dynamic of leadership in Sierra Leone?
Well, to a certain extent, the diamonds are restricted to certain areas. I mean, diamonds used to be very pervasive in maybe two-thirds of the chiefdoms in the country. But most of the very good resources are found in Kono and Kenema. Kono especially. And the thing about Kono, Kono has the Kono tribe are the dominant tribe in Kono. And they are a bellwether state. If you want to win elections in Sierra Leone for any of the major parties, southeast, there is a southeast-northwest divide. But Kono can go either way. And Kono support is very important. And since Kono is the resource-rich area, you've had a lot of splinter groups there. You have some paramount chiefs that may weigh in on one party or another. So placating the Kono people is very important. So in that sense, diamonds play a very large role because diamonds are the mainstay of the Kono economy. However, Sierra Leone, as you know, we have not managed our diamonds very well. There is this resource cost issue. The amount of diamonds that we've mined since independence is astronomical. But I always, as a mining engineer, say the problem is not with the diamonds or with what we earn from diamonds. It's how we use those resources.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a lot of diamond companies. We've also had artisanal mining mined by individuals with that have access to very little resources but have supporters. We've had these diamonds for a very long time, but we don't see Kono growing. We don't see the country improving. So it's how we use these resources that has been the problem, more so than anything else. So
of course,
we have the resource cost problem, I admit.
Yeah, so what is the core of that problem, sir? What would you say? Because as you said, you know, Norway has a lot of oil. Saudi Arabia has a lot of oil. UAE, they're many countries we could point to today that are heavily reliant economically on resources, but have been able to use those resources to develop their economies. And you go to the countries and it's gleaming highways and, you know, things are functioning. The police is there when you call them and whatnot and whatnot. So what do you think is the core of the problem in many African states that these resources have now turned into a curse?
Well, with us in Sierra Leone, I would say we have not diversified our economy enough. Mm. From the 60s and 70s, you read about the economy of Sierra Leone. It says diamonds contribute, or mining contributes, about 80% of the economy, and maybe 20% of exports, 20% of GDP. It's still the same. The figures have not changed much. The thing is, the money that we earn from those resources, we have not plowed into other sectors of the economy. So when you look at the contribution of manufacturing, of tourism, where we could earn a lot of money, and other areas, and agriculture, they have not really improved much. We think that we'll have this well of diamonds that is always coming, well of resources that we'll always earn money from. But now the resources are dwindling. You've run out of most of the artisanal diamonds that are very close to the surface. So the diamonds that are there, the large part of the resources, is kimberlite. And you have to go underground to mine them. You need big companies to do that. And some of those big companies started off well, but some are having problems because of the of policy issues, investments issues in Sierra Leone. And as you know, more recently, the price has fallen off the diamond, bottom has fallen off the diamond price. So that is affecting some of the mining companies as well. What really the mistake we made is we have not diversified enough. And also something that we caught on more recently is that we are now using some of those resources for development of the local areas. For example, when you read the Mining Act, it allows you to give some money, a certain percentage of the revenue, to the local area for development purposes. Mm-hmm. The Environmental Act also allows you to get up a community development action plan for community development of the local area. So there's quite a bit of those resources coming into the local areas. And I think that is an improvement. It could be better, but that's at least an improvement. I wish it had happened earlier, because we're now catching up to that idea that we need to develop local areas and not just allow diamond money or mining money to come into the central economy. And then you have a government that is profligate and just uses the money as it wants. Mm. That has been the problem. We have not managed our economy well.
And that's interesting, sir, because you brought up, you raised the issue of, you said, people having that belief that, oh, you know, we have diamond wealth here, so we can always sort of fall back on that, or we can always use that. This is an interesting trope. I wonder, and I'm bringing it up because in the context of Nigeria, also where I come from, there is still that kind of belief people have. Definitely at the crowd level, at the mass level, regular citizens, but also perhaps even at higher up levels, elite level, that, you know, quote unquote, Nigeria is a rich country. So even though with over 200 million people at the moment, we have just a GDP per capita of $1,000, which is very, very low, people still have that belief, almost as if there is unimaginable trillions of dollars worth of wealth in the country. And some say that has created a sort of mindset where people are not so focused on productive activities, but are more focused on consuming the unimaginable wealth they believe exists. Now, taking into consideration Sierra Leone is, of course, a smaller country and lesser resources potentially. Do you think there is that kind of mindset problem there, that the people imagine that, oh, you know, there is so much wealth that all we have to do is just mine it properly and distribute it fairly and everything would be fine and we don't really need to do much else? Of course, simplistically put. But do you think there exists that kind of mindset problem at the sort of regular level, regular citizen level, and perhaps also at the elite level? Or perhaps you don't think it exists?
There was that mindset. You're talking about 1-2 decades ago, there was that mindset. Mm. That was when we had lots of alluvial diamonds to mine. That was when the economy was not really that bad. Even in terms of iron ore, there was a time when we had a big boom when President Nkrumah was in power with iron ore exports. So there was the tendency of governments and people to think that we have this well of money, that if we manage it well, there's money coming in. But now that the resources are running out or much more difficult to mine. I think people are talking about diversifying the economy. If you look at Sierra Leone's medium-term development plan, like the five pillars that they have now, one is a Feed Sierra Leone program, which is really agriculture-based. Let us feed ourselves. Rice is our staple food. We should be able to feed ourselves. There is the issue of technology development. There is the issue of youth unemployment. So all of those issues are now being factored into development plans. So it's not as if to say we don't know where we're going. We know what we should be doing. The problem is not really with the policies in Sierra Leone. The problem is the transmission mechanism from policy to reality. It's the people that implement the policies. They have a policy, for example, on private sector participation. We want enhanced private sector participation in the economy. But I work in the private sector, and I know that government, not only this government, the encouragement of the private sector is very lukewarm. There are things that they could do to improve the private sector. And people forget, unfortunately, you have people that have been in governance, that have left governance, and come to the private sector, and then they start complaining about government. Oh, I went to this office and they dragged this thing out. It's the same thing you were doing when you were in office. So they tend to forget that the private sector is the engine of growth. That is being drummed into them. Development partners are always touting that. But governments, when they come into power, because of the majoritization of our politics and you who are in power control the resources, they want everything to be controlled by themselves. So it's this inordinate control that sometimes messes us up. And unfortunately, you don't have a lot of people with integrity that manage our systems.
Very interesting, sir. And you talked about how you said the problem are not policies, but is the implementation of these policies. Again, this is also something I hear talked about very often in Nigeria and in other countries, that the Nigerian government office is full of fantastic policies in filing cabinets, but the problem is with the implementation. So sort of breaking it down again to that sort of practical everyday level, where do you think the biggest obstacles are to the implementation of good policies in Sierra Leone, which you have suggested exist? The policy plans are there. So where does the implementation go wrong? We talked about some of the problems at the top, but are there some issues also in the middle somewhere, if you're talking about mid-level, you know, bureaucrats? Or what are some of the other issues that prevent good policies on paper from becoming reality?
I really think that governments should be committed to both diversifying the economy and also to passing on things to the private sector, improving the private sector. I'll give you an example. They had a privatization commission to privatize state-owned enterprises, various forms of privatization, from management contracts to hiving parts of the companies up to wholesale privatization. And they had a plan. But you still had people within the system who wanted to keep those state-owned enterprises for what they can have. And those state-owned enterprises are heavily subsidized by government. So government sometimes is not committed to those. I mean, when they show some commitment, it makes a difference. When they showed some commitment to the telephone companies, telecoms, to privatize, it's working fairly well now. They're showing some commitment to other areas. It works well. I'm working in the power sector now. They're showing some commitment to the private sector participation. I think it will bode well for Sierra Leone. But they need to shake off some of these things, because government ownership is not the solution. I mean, you may have good people in there, but they very soon get corrupted. They either get corrupted or the system works against them. You see light at the end of the tunnel, and they create more tunnels. They never want that tunnel to end.
Interesting.
That is the problem. And the commitment of government is important to that.
Interesting.
And as you mentioned, you run the main company responsible for electricity supply in Sierra Leone. And I don't know what the situation is with electricity in Sierra Leone. I know in Nigeria it's very bad, and in some other African countries where I've spoken to people about this also, it's quite bad. I teach a module on African international politics at the University of York in the UK. And one of the statistics, which is always, I think, most shocking to my students, is that statistic of 600 million Africans not having access to electricity. I always see absolute shock on the face of students that, what, in 2025, how is that possible? That many, 600 million? So focusing now on Sierra Leone, what do you think are the challenges? You know, why don't all Sierra Leoneans have 24-hour electricity?
First of all, the access rate right now is about 36%. Mm-hmm. About a decade ago, 15 years ago, it used to be about 10%. So it's improved somehow. Mm-hmm. But we have the aspiration by 2030 to raise it to about 80%. But that's a fairly tall order. And you need a lot of massive investment in terms of new transmission lines, new sources of power, even though now you can have independent power providers. But even if they provide power and you buy it, the transmission line has to be okay. The distribution system is quite messed up. The authority itself is messed up, ETSA, which I head now. We've had lots of crises. We have a money crisis. There's no financial resources to resuscitate this institution, run it, have new distribution lines, new sources of energy. Even though donors help, there is a financial problem. There's also an efficiency problem. You have lots of people working in the institution that are not fit for purpose, lots of technologies that they're using that are moribund now. Then you have an access crisis. You have to raise this access from 36 to 80%. You cannot do that with government oversight now. So we've agreed and with our development partners, and government is very supportive, may I say, of having private sector participation. We have bid rounds going out right now. In about 6 months' time, early next year, God willing, we may have a private sector partner come in and run the institution for us. But that will be done as an SPV with the government. The government will still own the assets. They'll have a concession, a 15-year concession. They'll have KPIs to keep to. But then they'll bring in some resources. And they bring in both human resources and financial resources. And we think that will help resuscitate the sector somehow. There are also initiatives that we're tapping into, like the MCC, Sierra Leone won the compact, but as you know, it's in trouble now. But you have other programs like Mission 300. So for the medium and long term, we have a reform plan drawn up with the help of our development partners. So what we have to do is to be disciplined enough to keep to those reform plans. And that reform plan is enhanced generation from independent power providers, making sure that at least 50% of the power comes from renewables by 2030. It involves having a transmission line backbone in the country. It involves a whole host of things that we need to do, but that needs good oversight. And that is what my board now is trying to provide. And we'll, hopefully government will be kept at bay and the private sector partner will run the show and be monitored.
Interesting. So this is an issue which you think extensive private sector commitment could pretty much solve. And I'm asking this because, again, going back to Nigeria, there have been efforts to privatize the power sector, and some private companies have come in and they've attempted to change the situation, and they've not been able to change the situation. And due to some of these challenges, you've talked about transmission lines, etc., in Sierra Leone, some of them complain that actually they don't have enough customers who are able to pay for the electricity. And so really, it's not a profitable venture for them long term, considering the investments. Are these issues that you think also could be challenges in Sierra Leone? Or do you think as long as a significant amount of private sector capital comes in, then it can be made into a profitable enough venture for Sierra Leoneans to be enjoying electricity like people in some other places?
Mind you, I'm not really advocating for an unbridled private sector, because there are still segments of the electricity that are supposed to be provided otherwise. Like you should have a rural electrification fund, a rural electrification board, and they have isolated power supply systems, solar systems, solar PV systems. There are a lot of them all over the country. They have been sponsored by EU and other donors. So that still has to go on, whereby you have the remote village that has access to electricity for the corn barry, for the hospital, for the schools, and so on. That program needs to go hand in hand with this. You do not forget about that segment of the population. But when it comes to the main population in the urban areas, if it's a well-run private sector enterprise, you can always play around with the tariff structure. There is still a lot of cross-subsidization. Those that are lower down the economic rung can be given power for very cheap. I mean, they're subsidized by industrial and commercial customers. So it depends upon how you set the tariff system. It also depends upon how the private sector partner is monitored, because you just need them unbridled. Profit motive takes precedence over everything else. So they have to be monitored. It depends on the agreement you sign with them. So we've been looking at this over the past few months and looking at what sort of agreement will work that will still protect our people. It may still be that we'll have problems along the way, but we should have systems of addressing such problems. But just going by what we've been doing, and the good thing is that we have commitment from the donors to say, just because you have privatization does not mean we cannot expand your grid, because the EDSA still owns the assets. We can expand your grid for you. We can invest in this and so on. So it becomes your own part of the assets of this joint venture that you have in. So it depends upon the model that you're having. I'm not sure it's going to be problem-free, but what my challenge would be and the challenge of my board would be, how do we oversee such things as well, so that it bodes well for the private sector partner and it bodes well for the customers, the populace. And it's quite a challenge.
Interesting. You are also currently the managing director of SEMATS Group, as we mentioned at the beginning, which is a private major engineering company in Sierra Leone. So I'm wondering, with your extensive experience in leadership experience in both the private sectors and the public sectors, how would you compare how it is to lead a private sector entity and a public sector entity in Sierra Leone? Are there huge differences? Are there some similarities? What would you say?
More than huge differences. In fact, apart from being chairman at present of EDSA, 20 years ago, 24 years ago, the President Kaba called us to run this entity, National Power Authority, and we were there for 3 years. We left SEMATS, the colleagues and I, to come and run it. It's a big problem. First of all, you've got the problem of government interference, government oversight, people doing things for private reasons, unsavory reasons. You've got government policy also not necessarily being kosher. Government, some of the policies are not really bent towards sustainability. They are short-term fixes just so that they don't look bad. They ask you, oh, can you supply some drums of diesel to this town and that town so that they can get electricity for a month or something like that. You have people that you employ that are forced upon you by politicians or government to the extent that the utility now, maybe half of the workers there are contract workers. So you have problems of government oversight. You have problems of resources. It says now we need about $50 million to sort out just the distribution problems, not even the transmission. Government hasn't got that kind of money. You have problems of paying IPPs. It's a problem. You have efficiency problems. You can't buy new meters, invest in new technology. So government oversight is bad. My company, SEMATS, yes, we are a multidisciplinary engineering company. We've also had our problems. And a lot of these problems are also linked to the economy of the country. But we try to circumvent them. You can plan long term. For example, one of the reasons why we're multidisciplinary is because if one door closes, you open another door. We do mining, consultancy, electrical, mechanical, civil. We've had quite some work in designing roads. We've had quite some work in mining policy issues. So sometimes one door closes, another door opens. And then you make strategic decisions based on your finances and based on how you see things going. And then you can afford to pay people good wages, depending on how much you earn. You attract some bright talent, you develop people and you train them. So there's a whole lot, it's like night and day between managing a private company like Siemens and coming to the power authority. Mind you, you have the same, one example I always give. We came from the mine when we set up our company, the five of us, we came from the mining sector. The world drove us into town and we came in and set up this company. And I used to give people an example. I said, the same guys that would run the power station in Freetown here and not run it efficiently, where the machines break down all the time, where they steal fuel, where they don't have spare parts, we employ the same guys in the mine to run our power station and they run it 24/7. Why? Because they've got good oversight, they manage well, they pay good wages. There is a system. That's the difference between private and public sectors.
That's very interesting. That's incredibly interesting. So I'm happy you brought that up. You said there is a system. You talked about oversight and people being incentivized. So the question now would be, what makes that difference between the private sector and the public sector in terms of incentivization and in terms of that system not being there in the public sector? Because it's not like the people working in the public sector role will be working for free. They are probably paid. There is also some status to being especially a higher up member of the public sector, somebody working in there, a director here or a manager there. There is some status that also comes with that within your society. So one should imagine there should be some incentives to do a good job. So where exactly is the problem, do you think, sir? And perhaps I may just bring this up here spontaneously. In 1975, Peter Eke, a Nigerian scholar, a brilliant Nigerian scholar, wrote an article about a tale of two publics. And he talked there about how actually he saw the problem within Nigeria then and other African post-colonial societies, being that while people feel strong moral obligations towards their family members and towards their wider, perhaps ethnic group, they don't necessarily feel those kinds of moral obligations towards the civic state, towards that public sphere. It's a sort of treated like a no man's land where you go in and take what you can and leave and then go and take care of your family and your immediate kinship group. Do you think there is still something in that lasts till today? If not, what's the problem?
The public sector has been very badly managed. They take the case of some of these parastatals or some of the big ministries and so on. Especially departments and agencies like, let me give an example, like Roads Authority, Environmental Protection Agency, there are a whole lot of agencies, regulatory agencies around. Whenever government changes, if you are number one or two in those agencies, you will face the chopping block. They will replace you. So there is no continuity. They've politicized all those positions. And they force the managers in those positions to employ people that are otherwise not fitted for the jobs. So they mess up your whole system. So you basically have people in there that are not fit for purpose. And then when you have the real public sector administrators, like the permanent secretaries, those are there for a longer term and they go through the promotion system, but they have very little influence because they are there just as administrators. When you jump into the regulatory agencies, to the departments and agencies that actually make things tick, not just the administrators, that's where the problem is. And when you're running those institutions, maybe they incentivize themselves because they get good salaries probably, or probably depend on some windfall or some unsavory acts that they perform. But the people at the bottom, they can't afford to pay them good wages because the institution is not running well. Take the case of the energy sector or the water sector. If it's not running well, you can't afford to pay good wages. For example, us here, half of our workers are casual workers handing a pittance, and you send them to go and do sensitive jobs of connecting or disconnecting people or giving them bills and so on. They obviously would not work well, they will not work honestly, because the resources are not there. Certain things that you could use technology to solve, you haven't got the resources to get the technological innovation in to be able to monitor. So the system is dragged out. You create a system that is very complex just so that at each stage people earn money. So it gets down to bad appointments, it gets down to bad oversight, it gets down to financial resources. And whatever you say, that is not there in that public sector or quasi public sector.
Interesting. And then, so how do you keep yourself going when it comes to that kind of long-term development work, especially with regards to the public sector? I mean, are there times at a human level that you feel like giving up? And if there are, you know, what do you tell yourself not to?
Well, there have been several times when I've thought about giving up, but when I think about the greater good, and when I also think about what help is available, because we're not alone. I mean, development partners come in. For example, in the energy sector, the World Bank is giving a lot of resources in terms of new equipment, new transformers, training, and so on. EU is giving a lot of help in terms of this solar PV systems that they use in rural areas. So the development partners know that we need this. They've helped us formulate a reform plan. They're coming in, it's almost like holding our hands, they're coming in. And it depends upon how government reacts to their coming in. And so far, government has reacted well. There is, for example, a reform program going on. So I know that things are bad at the moment, but I know if I can help steer the institution towards going by this reform plan as best as I could, in 6 months' time, in a year's time, this will be a different institution. So that spurs me on to say I can be part of the change. Also, despite all the things that I've said negative about public sector, not everybody is bad. I've worked in an institution like this where you've got some damn good engineers and some damn good people that really want the institution to change. They themselves are embarrassed when the lights go out, when they criticize us in public, and they want to change things. So you can identify those people. There are a few of them, and you can have some reform champions. It is quite possible that there are some good people, and some of those good people are the people that spur me on as well.
Interesting. And finally, sir, looking forward and speaking to a proverbial 25-year-old African who may be listening to us now and who wants to enact change in their society, wherever that may be in Africa, what would you say to them in terms of how do you lead in a space where problems are plenty, mistrust is high, and people can often feel jaded after years of disappointments and broken promises by their leaders? What would you say to that 25-year-old African?
Well, what I would say to them, a lot of our ministers are in their 30s. Late 30s, early 40s. They have a lot of young people. Young people now being thrust into positions of responsibility. I'll just tell them, the fact that you're young does not mean that you will, I know you'll bring innovative ideas, I know you've got a drive and so on, but a young person can just be as corrupt as an old person. So a lot of integrity is important. Also, try to make your voices heard. You may not do this singly, but join professional organizations. You can make your voices heard collectively. Like the Institution of Engineers is a big force here in Sierra Leone. The Lawyer Society is a big force. You can make your voices heard on national issues. You can also, if you want to get involved in politics, yes, you may get involved in politics. There is no reason why you cannot make yourself known and contribute to social activities that are going on. Yes, I know that the economy is bad. Yes, I know it's difficult for you to just come off college and get a job, but a lot of people I know now are getting engaged in entrepreneurship. There are lots of people working for us in some of these companies that do some side hustle. They have something they're doing, especially the young ladies. They're keeping themselves engaged. I know that things will not change overnight. The problems of youth unemployment is big. The educational problems are big. There are problems created by the political system. But don't despair. You can stay in and still be part of the system and fight it. And you don't necessarily need to be corrupt to fight it. You can be a person of integrity. I have picked up a few young people in my company that I know have worked hard, and I've recommended them to work in mining companies. Today, some of them are big managers there, and they even give us jobs. And they're regulatory agencies. They are doing well. Some of them have gone abroad. They're doing well. So don't despair. Have a mentor. Behave with integrity. Collectively join your professional organizations and hope for the best.
Andrew Cayley, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you, Remy.
Thank you for listening to How to Become a Leader in Africa. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to subscribe and like and review the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps more people discover these vital discussions. You can also visit our website to drop your comments and suggestions, which we always welcome. Join us next time as we continue exploring the logic of leadership in African societies. Till then, take care of yourselves.